13. Lift off, show wise. Good morning, Pear Tree, I bellow as I enter the offices of my Prodco production company. Good morning, Alan, replied my staff. How are we today? I continued, genuinely wanting to know. Great, not bad. Back still playing up. Very well, fine. Bit tired as my neighbours decided to do the fucking hoovering at 2 o'clock in the fucking morning, reply my staff. By now, Pear Tree Productions was a well-oiled machine. We had some great people working at optimum level. Jason had been promoted to an assistant producer and had a newfound confidence since his psoriasis had cleared up. I'd taken on George Dwyer as creative director. He'd worked as a PR man for the Russian circus and had some daring, out-there ideas, few of which made it through compliance. He's been living in the Wormwood area of West London for 10 years. Jill on reception was good to have around the place, clinging on to the last of her good looks and happy to buy chalk treats for all of us every Friday. Rupert Summers, who had experience of live TV from manning the telephones on ITV Telethon 88, would produce the show. But it was Lewis Hurst, a theatrical agent who had invested some money in the company, who really pulled the strings. A bear-like homosexual, he was well-connected and well-to-do in a way that put some people massively on edge. But it was Lewis who put in a call to Roger Moore and secured him as a guest on our first show. It was also he, with a trademark tuft of jet-black nasal hair hanging down from each nostril, who had rushed into my office one day to tell me that the celebrated chanteuse Gina Langland had agreed to appear in Show 3. But there were quite a few others in the company too, who I'm unable to name. I've not forgotten them, having not known what they were called in the first place. My management style was that of an estranged father, at times caring, at times distant, and with little or no interest in the individuals under my charge. And believe me, it just works. The show began and was an unmitigated success. Viewing figures collapsed as the series went on, but only because it was getting lighter in the evenings and more people were out rambling or sitting in beer gardens. The fan mail came in by the sackload. Jason suggested I save it until the end of the series so that I could maintain concentration, which I did. The sacks of letters were sadly destroyed in a fire before I could peruse them. There were only one or two hiccups, but that's the nature of live television, and I honestly don't think people noticed. Again, some of the guests were a little surly, but that has to come down to the booker, and at the end of the series, Jason was duly dismissed. He went on to make his name producing a certain Orwellian house-based reality show that demeans us all. Tony Hayes gave us a few notes after the first show, and repeated the same ones after the second, third, and fourth, but crucially didn't after the fifth or sixth, which suggests he was deeply satisfied with the trajectory of the series. We also bore in mind that he was only in the role to cover Georgia Harrison's maternity leave, so we didn't need to keep him on side for the long term. Success came very naturally to me. I'd go into a steakhouse or a swimming pool, and people would turn and exchange knowing glances. I was suddenly hot, appearing on Through the Keyhole and Points of View. I was also a guest on Clive Anderson's chat show. I could get tables at a moment's notice. I was stopped on the street by people telling me how unbelievable my show was. I was hot, and it felt good. And then, live on air in the sixth and final episode of my chat show, I shot a man through the heart with a gun.